Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. The government is set to raise the country's statutory debt ceiling for the second time in just a little over a year to 65% from 60% of GDP previously. Malaysia last raised its statutory debt ceiling from 55% to 60% of GDP in August last year. The COVID-19 fund size was also increased by 20 billion ringgit to 65 billion after budget 2021 was tabled last November. Now, the finance ministry says that the increase will enable the government to fund 45 billion ringgit in extra spending on economic aid and stimulus packages. But what might the short-term and long-term implications of this move be? Let's ask Nadia Jalil. She's the regional head of group economics and market analysis for CIMB Group. She joins us on the show now. Nadia, can we begin with perhaps your initial thoughts on the move to increase the country's statutory debt ceiling to 65% of GDP? I'm just wondering whether you think that this was a necessary move.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Sharad and Melissa. Thanks so much. Yes, it actually was necessary from a legal perspective as well, because what we do have is the statutory limits in terms of our debt ceiling. So I think it's in the Local Loans Act, amongst others, that actually mandates that we do need, that we are subject to a 60% currently debt ceiling. So I think I last looked at these numbers, and as of the second quarter of 2021, the debt to GDP percentage is actually at 64%. So unless we want to come to a position where we might come across either a legal or political crisis, administratively speaking, the increase in the debt ceiling was actually quite necessary. The question is whether 65% is enough, given that the current total, the current estimate, is actually about 64% right now. And another issue that I think gets lost in the discussion is that, legally speaking, the government debt, national debt, can only finance development expenditure. It cannot finance operational expenditure such as emoluments or supplies, and supplies does include the vaccines and other medicines that we need in order to combat COVID-19. Which I guess in relation to that is why the government also had to dip into the quad, the 5 billion, in order to finance the vaccines.
Nadia, your general agreement about this move, do you sense that there might be detractors out there who are worried that that the government, you know, having been allowed to borrow more money might not actually be more stringent with the money it uses, there might not be sufficient scrutiny, or that they might be profligate? I mean, are these concerns at all?
I think these are valid concerns, really, because the statutory debt limit is really a blunt instrument to ensure that there's no profligacy in terms of how the government spends its money in order to limit its money. But, you know, if you think about the fact that, say, the US, for instance, and the debates that they're having in Congress there in terms of raising their own debt limit, where their actual debt limit is about 115% to GDP, the UK is about a debt to GDP of about nearly 100%. Japan has about 200% debt to GDP. And Singapore, you'd be surprised to know, has actually about 146% to GDP debt right now. And these are countries that, you know, are known for, you know, generally healthy fiscal management. So whilst there are concerns that, you know, in terms of whether raising the statutory debt limit might imply that the government or other policymakers or those in charge might actually be able to spend more of that money and might not spend it wisely, shall we say.
Right.
The actual number itself is not the concern. So you're right, Sharad, in the sense that these concerns should actually be addressed through other measures. So if you wanted to sort of mitigate the concerns of, say, foreign investors who may raise concerns about the fiscal sustainability of the government or how the nation is actually managing its finances, on the other side, you'd have to have, you know, stronger oversight plans and actually also commitment to either reduce the debt or be more transparent about what that debt is being spent on.
Okay, and what would you like to see this the expanded fiscal space be used? What would you like to see the government use that money to fund?
So one thing, obviously, in terms of what we've seen in terms of the gaps that have widened with the pandemic, the discrepancies in health services and health facilities between certain states as well as urban and rural areas. So I think that should be the priority. Again, given that the debt is currently only able to fund development expenditure, so it really is in building more facilities, in getting better and improved equipment for our hospitals. Another investment that I like to see is really in terms of infrastructure investments to combat climate change. And you can actually think about tying this with a sort of Green New Deal, for instance, where, you know, we have a long-term plan to combat climate change. And I think the recent 12-nation plan actually did sort of touch upon this, but it needs a bit more elaboration. If you had a wide-ranging public investment plan to maybe retrofit government buildings, perhaps implement investments for renewable energy, and also tie that with a public jobs initiative, that would be a way to actually not just combat climate change and help save us, reverse whatever effects we've had from climate change, but also generate employment as well as growth. Other areas that I like to see in terms of investment, and this is really a tall order, it's in terms of obviously telco infrastructure, particularly in rural areas, as well as water security. I mean, we're I think three of us possibly live in are facing water cuts for the next 4 days, right? And it's telling that we still don't have, say, an auxiliary water system in this day and age.
Yeah, Nadia, maybe you should be the Prime Minister's economic advisor.
Why would you do that to me, Sharad?
Okay, so that job's been taken. I want to come back to the debt ceiling and ask you, is there any kind of impact? Because I know that the American debate is very different from ours, their governance structures are very different, and so on and so forth. And but there's always this question of the impact for the man in the street, the woman in the street, in terms of his or her housing loan, car loan, and so on and so forth. Will we see something of that in the move here?
Do you mean whether or not the national debt actually impacts our personal debt?
Yeah, and whether the raising of the debt ceiling will make borrowings more expensive, will there be interest rate hikes, and so on and so forth. I mean, is there any implication that might affect that person, the kind of on an everyday level?
I wouldn't think so, because actually, if we are going to take on more national debt, more debt at the government level, the time is actually now. And that window is sort of narrowing because the cost of that debt might go up as economic recovery takes place in other areas of the world, such as the US. So what could happen is if we postpone taking on more debt, the cost of that debt might rise as interest rates rise. So it doesn't actually link with each other in that direct manner. So I think
Nadia,
one of the misconceptions.
You said 60. You asked whether 65% of GDP is actually enough. What percentage would you like to see, Nadia?
See, this is the thing. There's no magic number. It really depends on what that money is spent on. And another factor that we've kind of ignored is really what are our national assets? So we know what our national debt level is, but we don't know what that debt has been financing, right? So is it financing infrastructure and investments that's going to generate more growth in the short to long term? And whether the debt itself that's financing those investments are of appropriate tenure. So, for instance, if we were going to finance, say, the MRT, another MRT line with debt, you'd want that debt to be generally long term so that the commitments come in once some revenue has come in from that particular investment. So, it really is in terms of revenue treasury management as opposed to a hard number itself.
All right. Nadia, thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. That was economist Nadia Jalil from CIMB Group. We're going to take a quick break here and consider this, but we will be back with more. We're going to be speaking to economist Jomo Kwame Sundrum after this. Stay tuned to Consider This. Hi, welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. With me is Sharad Kutan. Let's continue our discussion about the increase of Malaysia's statutory debt ceiling to 65% of GDP. How do we ensure that the expanded fiscal space will be used wisely and deftly to speed up the country's economic recovery? Joining us on the show now is economist and former UN Assistant Secretary General, Dr. Jomo Kwame Sundrum. Jomo, you were an early advocate calling on the government to be creative in the way it approached its fiscal policy measures. I remember we spoke to you early in the pandemic stages last year, and you had talked about the need for borrowing because it's relatively cheap at the moment. Are you happy now, looking back at how the government has approached, raising the debt ceiling twice in the past 26 months?
I think it's quite necessary for the government to raise the debt ceiling, especially in the circumstances. It needs to borrow and spend in order to provide sufficient relief to finance recovery and, most importantly, to finance reform. However, I am concerned that there are not enough safeguards to ensure that the additional spending is well spent. And that is the crux of the matter. The other major issue in connection with government debt is that there is still a huge amount of money which is borrowed from abroad. If we think, for example, about 1MDB or you think about ECRL, a lot of this is off budget. It is borrowed in the form of government-guaranteed debt. The government is liable to pay, but it does not go to Parliament. Parliament does not scrutinize it. So what we need is a far more efficient and effective Public Accounts Committee, bipartisan, of course, and also careful scrutiny of what is being done on a much more updated basis, rather to ensure that any mistakes, any problems, any abuses are immediately checked, so to ensure the efficacy of this additional spending.
Jomo, we just spoke to Nadia Jalil, and she expressed how she would like to see that spending, that extra spending or that extra money spent on, looking at the kind of gaps that have been revealed by the pandemic. But when you look at this government, the current administration of Ismail Sabri, compared to the Muhyiddin administration and the Pakatan Harapan administration led by Dr. Mahathir before him, do you see any kind of policy differences, philosophical differences between them that might give us a sense of how this money will be spent, whether it will, kind of reach the mark of being creative, innovative, considering the global circumstances we're in?
I would say that the Pakatan Harapan did promise a great deal in its manifesto. It didn't do enough to get it going. Some of the easier reforms could have been done almost immediately, and those things were not done as quickly as they should have been done. And some of the more longer-lasting, more difficult reforms should also have been taken further down the road, but unfortunately they were not. The change of government subsequently, of course, was significant, and we see a fairly significant change in the priorities, far more playing to the ethno-populist base and so on and so forth. But for all intents and purposes, I think the story really changes partly because of COVID-19. COVID-19 has forced everybody to rethink what is the basis for economic growth in Malaysia, and to ensure that the temporary recessions due to COVID-19 and, more importantly, the stay-in-shelter lockdowns do not do not procrastinate and become, depressions. This is extremely important. Things were not good before COVID-19 as well, and much more needs to be done to ensure that the reforms are introduced and implemented. There is some promise of this in the new Malaysia plan. Not enough, in my view, but still, it is promising. But we know from past experience over the last four decades that there's a huge gap between what is in the Malaysia plans and what is actually implemented. The last time these Malaysia plans were taken seriously was way back in the 1970s.
Right. I have to agree with you on that. But just to come back on to focus on, we talked about the debt ceiling and what you'd like to see in terms of fiscal policy. I'm just wondering, if we were to look at monetary policy, what would you like to see come up from that space? What role do you think the central bank should be playing in the recovery of the economy as we emerge out of this pandemic?
Well, there are huge problems with monetary policy even before the COVID-19. And I think that there are some difficulties with using monetary policy instruments as well. Simply lowering the interest rate and the usual kinds of things are not particularly effective. They're very blunt instruments in terms of dealing with the challenges which we face today. I think the major role, of course, in my view, is that the central bank should be enabling direct lending to the government, to the treasury, in order for the government to borrow. This should not be intermediated by financial markets. Going to financial markets basically ensures that the government is vulnerable to the vagaries of the market, and this is something to be avoided. So this has been enabled in many other countries, and we have seen, for example, that neighboring countries such as Indonesia and the Philippines have also done this on a temporary basis. In other countries, it has been done on a much more permanent basis. So enabling government lending is crucial.
Jumbo, for the layperson, what would be the, how would you explain the hazards of this move? Or is it just a simple administrative issue? Why not? Why wouldn't Malaysia, or why would government hesitate to do this?
You see, what we need, what Malaysia needs right now to get the economy going again is liquidity. You need people spending in Malaysian ringgit. We do not have, unlike some other countries, less fortunate countries, we do not have a major foreign exchange constraint. We do not need to borrow from abroad, which is what happens when you go to the market. You're basically borrowing foreign exchange. We don't need that. All we need to do is to get people to start spending again. And because incomes have contracted in the last year and a half, what we need is to stimulate that spending through government spending in the interest of the people, in order to ensure recovery and also, very importantly, to bring about needed reforms. There are some spending measures which I believe would have very huge knock-on effects. For example, if you have a school feeding program which would involve farmers directly feeding, providing food, vegetables and fruits, especially to the school feeding programs and so on and so forth, you would have a much healthier population. You would also have much safer and healthier food available through that program. You can really do, it will be very transformative, both in terms of farmer agriculture, small farmer agriculture, as well as for the younger people of our country.
Right, so there is kind of a ripple effect. Joma, I'm just wondering, when you talk about spending, increasing spending, is that figure, that number, 65% of GDP, which is self-imposed, is that enough? Should we be aiming for more, borrowing more to spend more?
Well, what bothers me about the government spending, current government borrowing, is the use of money held in trust in Kwan. That money has been primarily derived from petroleum revenues and is meant to be held for future generations who will no longer have the advantage of having a revenue stream from petroleum, because petroleum and natural gas will be exhausted at some point in the future. This is the intent of Kwan, and we are basically dipping into that, and without any promise to replenish that. And in a sense, it is a betrayal of the younger generation by the older generation to do that. And this, I think, is a very unfortunate measure. Perhaps that might be the best way to secure the needed funds, but it should be on a temporary basis. It should be on a loan basis rather than something to be acquired by this generation at the expense of future generations.
Jomo, do we have a problem because of our politics? Meaning, you know, this current administration might be maybe a year long before it goes to an election, and there's still a lot of uncertainty. Can any policy really be coherent or sustained or, you know, dependent upon because of the political volatility that we might see in the coming years?
The deal between the ruling coalition and the major opposition coalition allows for a certain degree of stability, especially as far as budgetary matters are concerned. And that should be the basis for some kind of understanding of these measures. And that's why I'm bothered that the opposition coalition has not qualified its approval of using Kwan funds in this case. But obviously, everybody wants to win the next election, and one can well understand this. And that's precisely why we must ensure that the additional spending, in fact, all government spending, is well spent. It's well spent for the purposes it is designated. We know all too well how billions have in the past gone to other purposes. I won't say nefarious, but that has been the case. But what is even more not obscure, what is not in the public eye, is the borrowing which is done in the name of government-established institutions for purposes such as the 1MDB and ECRL and a host of other projects which are never going to ever pay for themselves.
Jomo,
and this is not subject to parliamentary scrutiny.
Right, understood. In the few minutes that we have left, I just wanted to, you know, you gave such a great example about how spending for you know, breakfast, for food at schools could have a ripple effect. And I'm just wondering, with the expanded fiscal space that the government says, you know, for this raising the debt ceiling will give some 45 billion ringgit of additional funds, what do you think it should the government should address in the near term, particularly as you know, businesses, households are struggling to get out of the pandemic-induced recession?
Well, I think the offer which Tan Sri Mahyudin made at the end of his tenure actually contains some elements of it. It shouldn't have been something offered as part of a bargaining chip in negotiations to preserve that last government of his. You know, having an all-of-government approach is so badly needed. We see ministries working at cross-purposes, and having a whole-of-society approach is absolutely essential to restore public trust, to restore credibility and confidence in government, as well as government information. Part of the problem why a lot of people have doubts about, for example, advice on the vaccines and other related information is precisely because confidence and trust in government is at an all-time low. So having a whole-of-society approach is a no-brainer. But these things should not be the subject of negotiation. But this has become rhetorical, and we need to be serious about this. So just saying all of nation and so on and so forth is not good enough. We really need to translate this into policies. And we need to help the government to recognize what this actually means. How do we involve, for example, civil society organizations and others whom the government has not been familiar with engaging? But this is, of course, a new government in some respects, and so it should have a sharp learning curve. And if it is incapable of learning quickly enough, then it, you know, at the next election, the government, the public can decide what to do with it.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. It's been a pleasure talking to you. That was economist Jomo Kwame Sundaram there, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. But before I leave you tonight, a reminder, as always, that you can get the latest information on COVID-19 vaccines at astroawani.com as well as our Astro Awani app. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutton, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching, folks. Good night.